Our beloved friend Dan Antko was eager to sing that song. He remains in intensive care at Wesley, and we continue to be deeply concerned about him. I would like to thank, on behalf of all of the rest of you, those people who have so generously and thoughtfully taken food to the Antko household while they were being visited by children from many different places. I think at times like that, people really discover how much a church means to them. I had a phone call a few days ago, and a voice identified itself as Larry Widmer, the solicitor. Larry solicits funds not for himself, but for all of us. He has been working very, very hard in an attempt to raise the money necessary to finish off Fellowship Hall in the building next door. He tells me this morning that he has 54,000 of the 75,000 needed. He also says he would like me to announce how gladly he will be accessible down in Fellowship Hall to anybody who has thought about doing something on that score and would like now to take care of it. If we are able to do this, then Fellowship Hall will be finished and ready for use very quickly. If we aren't, we will wait a while. That will be up to us. I had planned to do something else this morning until I read an article in a religious journal that answers so many questions about how Mother's Day began and flourished that I hoped you might enjoy my sharing it with you. The article was written by a professor of church history in the seminary of Drew University near New York City. And it's the best quick history I have ever seen of how this secular celebration got into the church calendar and became an enormous religious and commercial success. Since I can count on an audience at UCC that likes to learn things, I feel optimistic about reading parts of this essay verbatim and summarizing the rest of it. Here's how it starts. Here we are. This was written a few days ago, on the eve of one of our odder hallowed days. On the second Sunday in May, churches across the country will again honor mothers. Some churches will recognize the oldest mother, and if not a matter of scandal, the youngest or most recent mother. Perhaps, too, congregations will applaud the mother with the most children attending with her. Mothers will wear flowers. Preachers will give suitable sermons. Choirs will sing fitting hymns. It's all right, Bob and JC, because this is probably not really a suitable sermon either. In many churches, especially in evangelical circles, this is one of the high days of the year. Even in those Protestant churches that have tried to recover the traditional Christian year and to minimize extraneous feasts, Mother's Day may still be celebrated. End of direct quote. The article suggests that churches may have little reason to make this a part of worship, except that they are influenced so powerfully by those who like having one more festival of consumption in America's heavily commercialized calendar. A religious purist here and there sees the day as another intrusion on the Christian calendar, one that sometimes falls confusingly on Pentecost Sunday. But we are in general so passive about such predetermined matters that most of us simply do not bother to think about it. I think it might be useful to think about it, no matter what our final conclusions may be. So here is the history of this day as Dr. Schmidt lays it out. It begins with a Methodist lady named Anna Jarvis, who spent much of her time early in this century promoting the new holiday. When her mother died on May the 9th, 1905, Anna wrote a series of recollections to help her friends and family remember an extraordinarily devoted Christian woman. She offered memorial gifts in her mother's honor to the Sunday school she worked with, and within a couple of years, she had organized a special service to commemorate her mother's long involvement with the church. By the time another year had passed, her vision had widened. She would now memorialize her mother by honoring all mothers with their own special day on the second Sunday in May. What inspired this grandiose plan, beside her devotion to her mother, is not clear, except that as a church organist and Sunday school teacher, she was well versed in the red letter days of American Protestantism. She knew how Sunday schools thrive on special occasions, Christmas programs most prominently, but also such events as Children's Day, Temperance Sunday, Roll Call Day, Decision Day, Missionary Day, and Anti-Cigarette Day. So this invention of Mother's Day was certainly consistent with her evangelical Protestant world. It's possible that she had heard of an earlier call for a Mother's Peace Day celebration by Julia Ward Howe, author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, in which mothers of the world would commit themselves to the cause of world peace. Or she may have heard of the old world custom called Mothering Sunday, which midway through Lent focused on returning home and paying homage to one's mother. But she never mentioned either one of these. Apparently, she was not one to spread the credit around. This was her idea and her day, and she protected it jealously all her life. In fact, she was so annoyed by others who took up the cause and offered their own versions of Mother's Day activities that she referred to them on occasion as grafters, infringers, trespassers, or deadbeats. Whatever forerunners there may have been, Anna Jarvis certainly deserves the lion's share of the credit for inventing Mother's Day. She was a fabulous organizer and a great letter writer. She got people like William Jennings Bryan to join the cause, along with the World Sunday School Association and the YMCA. Her church, the Methodist Episcopal Church, formally embraced her holiday at its general conference in 1912. Governors and senators fell quickly in line with the idea. After all, mothers do vote and may influence their children. And Woodrow Wilson's presidential proclamation made the holiday national in 1914. One Congregationalist paper was so wrought up over the rising prominence of Mother's Day that it said, "Not Christmas, not Easter, nor Children's Day has stirred such depth of sentiment." This phenomenal success was clearly due to more than the doings of one pious and dedicated woman. In fact, the shape it took and the directions it went were quickly beyond Anna's control. It reinforced this holiday, the ideal of evangelical Protestants, that women stayed at home to rear a family. It echoed the conviction of politicians that virtuous mothers kept the republic sound and strong. And it delighted business leaders, especially florists, who were quick to see the profit potential. The new holiday may have had a web of private meanings and memories for Anna Jarvis, but in its public unfolding, Mother's Day added all kinds of new threads. One of them, commercialism, quickly became dominant. Anna had imagined Mother's Day as a holy day, a kind of Sabbath celebration of maternal love and patience, but not as a holiday at the disposal of what she called trade vandals and trade pirates. Embittered by what she described as greedy tradesmen, she lashed out at those who have feasted on our cause and who seemed willing, in her words, to take the coppers off a dead mother's eyes. She must have been quite a lady. She fought the florist industry, which was her archenemy, along with other trade groups, but with little luck. At her most severe, she urged people not to buy any gifts at all for Mother's Day, especially not flowers and greeting cards, and simply encouraged people to visit home or to write Mother a long letter. At times, some of the churches explicitly joined Anna in her resistance to commercialization. One writer in the Christian Advocate worried that Mother's Day was becoming but a tool of commercial interests, that the spiritual value of this festival of the Christian home were being obscured in an onslaught of expensive gifts and falsely sentimental advertising. But timing was against those churches and against Anna's hopes, because 2 years after Mother's Day was founded in 1908, the Florists Telegraph Delivery Association was founded, and 4 years after that, the National Association of Greeting Card Manufacturers. So with the help of the advertising industry, the American calendar was transformed in these decades into a kind of festal cycle that helped sustain the expanding consumer culture. And Mother's Day was swept along with all the rest. And if the influence of commerce outside the churches is obvious, inside the religious world, the golden opportunities also quickly became apparent. Denominational publishing houses sold souvenirs, postcards, bookmarks, special bulletins, and celluloid buttons. Church leaders discovered that if they advertised it right, Mother's Day might pack the house almost as tightly as Christmas and Easter. I remember, and I looked around this room to notice that this is not apparently nearly so common anymore, but I remember very well how important it was as a child to know that one wore a red flower if Mom was alive, a white flower if she were not, a practice promoted, I didn't know this at the time, by a little jingle that was intended to widen the variety of flowers that could be associated with this day. Well, you have to admire ingenuity. I do. Anna Jarvis had advertised white carnations. That's what she wanted for everybody. But the florist's jingle made it possible to add flowers much more expensive than carnations. It said in these two lines, "White flowers for mother's memory, bright flowers for mother's living." So, as with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which was an invention of Montgomery Ward, or Mrs. Santa Claus, which was a contrivance of Westinghouse, our modern folklore has often sprung from clever advertising. But the churches were never entirely at the mercy of commerce and had their own interpretations of the holiday. It offered the assurance, as one writer put it back in 1917, that, and I want to be sure this is seen as a quote and not as my statement, women are still at their old tasks, and it was a ritual way of enclosing all women in motherhood, whether they had children or not. Anna Jarvis herself never married and never had any children. And to give her fair credit, she had a touch of tart feminism that I rather relish. She liked to point out that the American calendar was terribly patriarchal. Washington's birthday as the father of our country, Memorial Day for our heroic fathers, Labor Day for laboring fathers, Thanksgiving Day for pilgrim fathers, and even New Year's Day for old father time. So Mother's Day was at least a kind of furtive opening for women in the Protestant calendar, although it was admittedly not an international Women's Day, which occurs on March the 8th, or a Woman's Equality Day, which occurs on August the 26th, both of which offer potential alternatives to Mother's Day, but to which churches have paid practically no attention at all. But special interest groups have invaded Mother's Day and used it for a variety of causes. Coretta Scott King led a Mother's Day march in 1968 in support of poor mothers and their children. And in the 70s, the National Organization of Women used Mother's Day to stage rallies for the Equal Rights Amendment. The gift to give your mother, they proclaimed, is equality. The holiday has been used for peace demonstrations, and to highlight boycotts of corporations selling infant formula to third world nations. And right now, especially in California, small groups of women are using the day to honor Mother Earth and the Mother Goddess. So it has been ingeniously employed. It's a fascinating thing to watch the evolution of this fairly recent special day in the church calendar. The day is a kind of text ready for all sorts of variant readings and interpretations. I suppose the surest lesson of Mother's Day is how it highlights the freedom of American Protestantism to invent and reinvent the church year. As for myself, I do not intend to spend one additional hour crusading for an end to the proliferation of holidays for churches to notice, although I will confess that even with the prospect of getting cards and gifts from 5 loving grandchildren, I was startled and dismayed to discover on one of my calendars a new holiday I have mentioned to you once before called Grandparents Day. It hasn't really caught on yet, but I would guess that it will. And after that, Sister's Day and Brother's Day and who knows what else to validate our special social relationships. I suppose, in all fairness, I should tell you how I would celebrate Mother's Day. A visit home, a lunch together, a letter, a special phone call, any of the ways by which all year long you have shown that you remember and that you care. And it might be a pleasant idea to do what many other churches do, have a meal right after service is over for all women, mothers or not, which is prepared and served by the men of the church. We would cook it and serve it and wash the dishes, and then, knowing my sex, we would wait with high hope and beautiful patience for the middle of next month when it will be Father's Day.